Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. You may recall coverage in the media about a month ago concerning a surprising revelation about Gatorade. It seems that this teenage girl in Mississippi happened to notice online that there's this ingredient in Gatorade that has been banned in the European Union and in Japan as a food additive. So she looked into it a little more and started this online petition for convincing PepsiCo, who owns Gatorade, to remove this industrial food compound. And 200,000 people signed the petition, and PepsiCo said, okay, we'll change it. But it has nothing to do with the petition. We were thinking of doing this for about a year. And it turns out that this ingredient is used in about 9 or 10% of soft drinks in the United States. And the New York Times left out something quite important about this story, but the reporter in the Los Angeles Times noted, not only is this ingredient, which is called bromated vegetable oil, BVO, not only is bromated vegetable oil banned, this synthetic chemical, as a food additive in the EU and Japan, but it has been approved in the European Union for use as a flame retardant. And we're drinking it, folks. I mean, a lot of Americans are drinking it. If you imbibe those chemical stews called soft drinks, you know, your body really, really wants water. So even if you're addicted to them, maybe in between the soft drink chemical stews, you could have some water. Anyway, that's quite astounding, especially the fact that, you know, as I say, 10 to 11% of the soft drinks have it. They put it in to stabilize the artificial colors so it won't separate. Ugh. Well, this is just another example of industrial chemicals that we're taking in to our bodies. And this has quite a lot to do with all the diseases, birth defects, ailments that have now been linked to the presence of industrial toxins in our system. And the first warning about this, of course, was back in 1963 when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, and that was focusing mostly on DDT going into the ecosphere, because they were spraying the crops after World War II so heavily for a long, long time. But she also talked about other toxins that are affecting humans. And then in the 1980s, I remember in the early 80s, Dr. Rosalie Bertell said the prognosis for the human species looks like slow death by poisoning, because this stuff is just ubiquitous. And in this country, you know, the corporations are allowed to put these industrial chemicals into use without testing them. Or they run their own tests. The government's not testing them. So a lot are just put directly into use without being tested, especially tested in a synergistic way of how they interact with other compounds inside of us. So this we all know, and for 40 years there was an effort to try to get the toxins out of our food supply and the products we use, the BPA in the plastic bottle so many people are using every day, of course. Sometimes they have to. And it was pretty much thwarted by the chemical industry and the manufacturing industry. The corporate sector didn't want to be bothered, inconvenienced about this, so they haven't. But then, in 2002, a book came out that really changed the thinking. And it's called Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things. And this book challenged this 40 years of thinking, gee, we should get more eco-efficient as we manufacture products. We should learn how to do a little less damage, learn how to retool things so we're not putting out quite as much pollution. And they said, no, that's not the goal at all. Just put that off the table. Let's start thinking of how to be eco-effective, how to make things, how to build things so that they enhance the environment and the health of people and animals and plants. That's the goal. So the two people who wrote this, Michael Braungart, who's my guest today, and William McDonough, they started a design firm, and they've put these practices into effect in many ways. And in this book, Cradle to Cradle, they have two major concepts. As I just said, one is this idea of not just doing slightly less damage, but really thinking through in a relational way, the way permaculture does. How does this relate to this? Instead of viewing this as a waste product, how could it be seen as something else? And their second major concept is waste is food. And by that they mean instead of this cradle to grave, you dig up stuff from the earth, you make a product with it, you toss it on the junk heap. This cradle-to-cradle concept is, if we really separated the making of things into two different kinds of streams of material, which would be the biological stream and then the technological or the technical stream, then at the end of a product life, if it's something that had to have both streams, they could easily be separated to be put into use for new things. Or if it was entirely biological, it would just decompose on the ground in a way that would do some good. So they say the reason so much ends up on the junk heap is at the end of a product's life, you can't separate out those two streams because of the way it was constructed. But if we were a little smarter about product design, so it would be able, we would be able to separate those out or have entirely ecological, then we could just keep putting things into new lives. And besides those two concepts, they tell a couple stories, which I remember now 10 years later after having read the book, because that's the way the human mind works. I always tell people who are going to make a public presentation, if the first time they've given a talk, that you can talk for 50 minutes, and if you tell a 3-minute story, and a year later you run into someone on the street who was in the audience, that person is going to remember the 3-minute story, not the rest of what you said. It's really fascinating how the human mind just perks up and pays attention when a story starts. It's the way we make sense of things, I think. And it's a very relational way to see how all the different pieces of information coming at us fit together and are coherent. So anyway, the one story in there was really interesting about this mill in Switzerland that made fabric. And they had this problem with the fabric they made for seat coverings, because they were using the usual industrial processes. So at the end of the process, the effluent that went out of the factory was very polluted with these toxic dyes that had to be used. And then they had trimmings left over after these seat cushion fabrics were trimmed that had to be burned. But they were so toxic that under Swiss environmental law, they couldn't be burned in Swiss incinerators. They had to be trucked to Spain, which had at that time more lax environmental laws, and incinerated there, putting the pollution into another part of Europe. So Michael Braungart and his team devised a project, and they actually invited about 60 companies to participate and have an inventory, a rethinking of how they were making things if they were using toxic substances, which they all were. So the 60 were not interested because they didn't want to reveal what chemicals they do use. And they ended up working just with this mill that made the fabrics. And first, he and his team did an inventory of all the toxic chemicals that are generally used, and they eliminated thousands of them from consideration, because if you use this, then you have to use additives, and you have to use another chemical treatment. It brings in more problems. And then they found 23 elements, compounds, that were not toxic, not harmful, that could be used to make this fabric. And they did create a new fabric. And then when the inspectors, municipal inspectors, came out to check the effluent water flowing out of the plant with this new production line, they said, there's something wrong here. The pipes must be broken, because this water has no chemicals in it. In fact, it's cleaner than the influent water going into your plant from the city source. And they said, no, it's not broken. That was the effect. They were actually putting cleaner water into the environment than came into the plant. So it was a fascinating example of what can be done. And then the other story they told was how William McDonough and Michael Brongart worked together on this redesign of the Ford Motor Company's Rouge River plant, which was about 100 years old when the current Ford, who's president of the company, decided to completely redo it and, just as it was in the vanguard 100 years ago, make this plant a 21st century plant. So they tell the story of how they really got everyone together who could possibly contribute to the totality of understanding the context. What is the ecosystem that the plant is located in? And, you know, they determined that if they had a green roof for insulation, you know, that's where they put a layer of soil, and then they have low greenery growing on it, and animals and birds come and live in it, and it insulates the building much better than anything, especially those asbestos tiles that after a while, you know, crack because the sun is beating down on them. And then it's designed in such a way that the rain just runs off and through the tubes, through the gutters, out into this wetland they made, which is originally there in between the factory and the river. And as the water goes through, percolating through the wetlands, before it reaches the river, it becomes very, very clean, very much cleaned. And there are lots of animals. So when the people, the workers, eat in the cafeteria with these big glass windows or cafe, whatever it is, they look out over the wetland at the wildlife and the greenery. It's very good for everybody's health. And, of course, inside they did all kinds of eco-effective design solutions. So those were the two stories that I remembered. Now, I'm going to introduce Michael Brongart, but we've just gotten a message that he's had some delay getting to the phone in Hamburg, Germany, where he told us he would be. So let's just go ahead and assume he'll arrive any moment. Michael Brongart is the co-author with William McDonough of the extremely important book Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things. This was published in 2002 and has been translated into many languages. And I just want to say, I think about this book the way the great William Morris, my man William Morris, observed in the late 19th century about John Ruskin's essay, The Nature of Gothic. He said this was one of the truly necessary books of the century, because it was so deep in the thinking and changed our thinking. At that time, what he was talking about is what they called the Gothic style, engaged with the natural world. It allowed the human to have free design in communion with the natural world. This was as opposed to the neoclassical style, right, where everything's numeric proportions and rigidly designed. So anyway, just as he felt the nature of Gothic was that deep and important a book, I really think Cradle to Cradle is. This book, greatly advanced the thinking about ecologically intelligent design that not only refrains from damaging nature, but actually improves the conditions of humans and nature. It really did make a big splash when it became out. It became instantly essential, I would say. So then in 2005, Michael Brungardt and William McDonough, who met at a party in New York, by the way, I think a lot of people went up on the roof to get some air, and there was some story that that's how they met. And when I read that, I thought, oh, that must be like in those cartoons where suddenly the flowers bloom and the birds start singing around their heads. The earth is so happy because Michael Brungardt and William McDonough have met, because what they've done together is so important. So in 2005, they established, they already had a design firm, and they established the Cradle to Cradle Certificate Program and the Intelligence Product System. Through this firm they co-founded, McDonough Brungardt Design Chemistry, known as MBDC, which is located in Charlottesville, Virginia. You can find their cradle-to-cradle certification symbol on many products now, such as cleaning products made by the brand called Method, carpet and flooring products made by Shaw Industries, and many others. And you can see this on the website. Michael Brungardt has done even more in Europe. He's the founder and scientific CEO of EPEA Internationale Umweltforschung, an international environmental research and consulting institute headquartered in Hamburg. I believe it's having its 25th anniversary this year. He's also the co-founder and scientific manager of Hamburger Umweltinstitut, a nonprofit research center, as well as director of Brungardt Consulting in Hamburg. In the 1980s, he helped to establish the chemistry section of Greenpeace International and subsequently headed that section. Ever since then, he's been involved with research and consulting for eco-effective products, that is, products and production processes that use materials in a loop of reuse of material streams. As I was saying earlier, the two streams, either the biological or the technological or technical. He was a co-author of the Hanover Principles of Design, Design for Sustainability, which served as development guidelines for the World's Fair in Hanover in the year 2000. Michael Brungardt holds a PhD in chemistry and process engineering and holds several academic positions, the most recent addition of which is the newly created Academic Chair for Cradle-to-Cradle Innovation and Quality at the Rotterdam School of Management, which is the largest public business school in Europe. Michael Brungardt, welcome to All Together Now.
Hello. Good evening. Good evening here. Good afternoon.
Sorry, I can't quite hear.
Okay, so can you hear me? Michael Brungardt is here.
Yes, that's better. Well, there's so much I want to ask you, and I think the first thing is, the book was, as I say, so exciting and instantly essential to everyone who had been thinking about green ways to make the things that society needs, and I'm just wondering about, first of all, what the effect was after the book came out. I know it's been translated into many languages. What was the first, say, ripple in those first two or three years?
Yeah, first of all, for some people it was not so easy to accept it.
Oh.
Because it's a little bit the opposite of what they have been looking for and dealing with for so long.
Uh-huh.
For example, a city like San Francisco wants to be carbon neutral, climate neutral. And I was just making fun and said, look, no tree is carbon neutral. So do we want to be more stupid than a tree?
Uh-huh.
A tree is beneficial for the climate. A tree is carbon positive.
Yeah.
So with all our brain, we want to be less intelligent than a tree. And that was not that easy for people who have been doing guilt management for so long, trying to be less bad and reducing, avoiding, minimizing their footprint.
Uh-huh.
We were talking about how to make a beneficial footprint instead of minimizing our footprint. So the first years was a little tough because people, it took time till people got the message, but now it's amazing how it seems like there are a lot of people from Israel coming to Hamburg working in the institute, and that isn't it great that there is a positive agenda coming from Germany. It's amazing, yes. Uh-huh. Not a less bad one.
Uh-huh.
And so we work with more than 16 different nationalities just here in Hamburg, and it's all about being good instead of less bad. Traditionally, people think they would protect the environment if they destroy a little less. They said, so please protect the environment, reduce your water consumption, reduce your energy bill, reduce your waste production. But you're not protecting, you're only destroying a little less. It's like if I would tell you, please protect your child, beat your child only 5 times instead of 10 times. It's only minimizing damage. So, and that's why it took, at the beginning, it was a little tough.
Huh. Uh-huh. You know, I looked on YouTube. There are some clips of excerpts from speeches you've given, and there's this one I thought so charming exchange where this young journalist is asking you a question. I think he's Dutch. And he's asking you something about what you teach in the cradle-to-cradle professorship at the business school in Rotterdam. And just your two faces together in the frame, because he's very, you know, young and dear and hopeful, and you're very kind, but you can see in your eyes you're the face of our generation that's been trying for 40 years to get this across. And it's a wonderful meeting of these two generations. And he asks you about what you're doing. I can't remember quite what he said. And he said, oh, no, but we don't teach people to do more with less. The earth can't stand it if we do more, make more. So I recommend that to people to take a look at. Well, I do want to hear more about what's taught at the school, but I want to go into what you think the effects could be for manufacturing in the United States. But I think before we do that, maybe you should explain the basics of the concepts to people. I did touch on them on the introduction at the beginning when you were still arriving, the two big concepts in the book of eco-effectiveness and then waste is food. But could you explain sort of how you generally explain the basics to people?
Yeah, so I could hear your introduction. So I was on the telephone line already, so I got your message. And I didn't explain it so well that you can do it much better than I can do.
Yeah.
The basics is, the question is, do we want to support the other species, and do we want to support nature instead of being less damaging? And it's about celebrating human creativity. It's celebrating life. It's looking at somebody and say, instead of saying like Al Gore, oh, we have an overpopulation problem, is to look at a child and say, how nice that you're here. Welcome to the planet. Because when you question, you see this in Israel, when you question the existence of people and say it's better you're not here, in the Gaza Strip, the same thing, then people become greedy and angry, and then they grab all the stuff. But even the poorest of the poor in the whole world, wherever they are, when they feel safe, when they feel accepted, when they belong to a healthy community, they are always generous and friendly, even to people they never met before. Because people want to be good. So we don't need to control people to be less bad. We can support them to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, sure, we can minimize our carbon footprint. For example, when you take an elevator in a building, we calculated just for 39-year-old vegetarian lady and for 93-year-old man as well. When this person is walking the stairs, at least it takes 5 times more energy to walk the stairs, because human calorie is so much more energy intensive than to take the elevator. Yeah? So if you want to minimize your carbon footprint, always take the elevator, because you can reduce your carbon footprint for 5 times. Yeah? And then you die a little earlier, you can minimize your carbon footprint even more. Yeah? So, but is it really what you want?
And have some Gatorade, too.
Yeah, you can cut your hair shorter, then you don't need so much shampoo. You can avoid eating bean products, so you're not producing so much methane. So all this type of guilt stuff you can do. If you fly naked in an airplane from Frankfurt to New York, and everybody would do this, it would save 3 tons of kerosene. Yeah? So everybody can do something to be less bad, but Is it really? No, we celebrate human footprint. Look, if you look at the biomass of ants, then you see that the weight of ants, these little insects, I could take termites as well, but nobody likes termites in the United States. So the biomass of ants, even they're vegetarians. It's funny that people don't like vegetarians. So, so even if you take the biomass of ants, the ants are pretty much like us. 80% of them eat a lot of meat, and they kill each other. They are really sometimes really not nice to each other, like we are. So if you look at the biomass of ants, you see that the weight of these ants is four times bigger than of human beings. And because ants never take elevators, they always take stairs, they work physically much harder, and they only live 3 to 6 months as an average, their biomass equals a calorie consumption of 30 billion people. So we are not too many, we are too stupid. So our engineering is not good enough. The difference between them and us is we are making waste. That's why we need to eliminate the concept of waste. It's not about zero waste. It's even not a world without waste, because when you think about a world without waste, you still think about waste. It's like when I tell you don't think about a pink crocodile, you think about a pink crocodile. Yeah? So I'm talking about a world where everything is nutrition. Things which get consumed, like food, like shoe soles, like brake pads, like detergents, need to be designed to be beneficial for the biosphere. Things which are just used as a service, like a washing machine. You're not consuming a washing machine like a TV set. These things are designed for the technosphere. Hmm. So there's no waste. Everything becomes nutrition because we want to have computers, so we don't want to live just like ants, so we want to have technical stuff as well. We want to have houses and windows, etc. And so what we do is we make buildings like trees, for example, buildings which clean the air instead of being less toxic. Yeah, buildings which clean water, buildings which are beneficial for the earth. We, a tree, buildings like trees, a tree makes oxygen, a tree cleans the air, a tree is a habitat for 200 other species. So why should we live bad when we can be good like a tree? And that's why we are doing reinventing all the products around the globe, and we, and Bill McDonough and I donated the rights for certification to an independent certification institute so that everybody has access to it. Different to Microsoft, we said we don't want to own this. It belongs to the whole world. And that's why everybody can go and get their stuff certified independently from us. So it doesn't need us anymore.
What is the website where they would look to get information about that?
It's just Cradle to Cradle Certified. You find
it. Cradle to Cradle Certification or Certified. You can Google it or something.
You can Google it easily. And there's a Cradle to Cradle Institute for Certification in California, and they do a lot of work to get very nice and great products certified to be used in a technical or biological cycle.
Right. Okay, we have to pause for a moment for the break now. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Michael Brongardt. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Michael Brongardt. His website is brongardt.com, B-R-A-U-N-G-A-R-T.com. So I'd like to ask you about the possibilities for manufacturing in the United States, which we hope is having a comeback in a new and more green way, based on this research and demonstration that's come out of the cradle-to-cradle work. But first I want to ask you a question about something. I picked up one of those priority mail flat rate boxes from the post office. In fact, I picked up a few, I guess. Some must have been in 2011, I just saw. And I was really thrilled to see that stamped on the box for priority mail, it says, USPS packaging products have been awarded cradle-to-cradle certification for their ecologically intelligent design. For more information, go to mbdc.com. Okay, so they have this silver level of the award, and they have your little logo there, cradle to cradle. And I thought, wow, you know, this is the way two people can really have an impact in the world if they're smart about it and have these great ideas and get them out there. But then I noticed on the next box I picked up, that one was dated, even though I picked it up in 2011, it was apparently created, it says, in 2009. And then the one that's stamped 2012 doesn't have the cradle-to-cradle certification on it anymore. So did they lose it, or what happened?
Yes, the companies lose the certification if they don't make progress.
Uh-huh.
Because we expect them to go on with innovation. It's about continuous improvement.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, there was just not willingness or ability to go on. And we cannot do greenwashing, because we do certification basic bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, which is somehow a little strange, because we are certifying with toxic and rare metals. But we do so because we want to be in line with other certification systems, to make sure that people understand the language. I would certify personally more with bacteria, with monkey,
ecological
gorilla,
terms.
Right. It's something like
levels,
that. We do so to be in line with that. On the other side, if companies are not willing or able to improve their product further, because the criteria are very strict, and so then they lose their certification, because we don't want to do greenwashing. We just want to make sure that they are serious about it. And sure, the real benefit from the beginning is that we exactly define what is in there. So we positively define everything. So if I would invite you for dinner, Charlene, I wouldn't tell you, it's free of chicken. But people make these claims about free of chlorine, and then there are other toxic and nasty stuff in it. So that doesn't help. So we positively define everything, that you can either put it in your compost, burn it in your fireplace, and put the ash in your garden without a filter, or that you put it back in the technosphere. And there is implementation plan with it. And if you don't do the implementation to really collect the stuff to put it back, to work on things where you still have issues, it cannot be certified anymore. That's just what it is. Because, look, we use in 1972, Devin Meadows came out with this report with the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth. And when I was a teenager when I heard that, and it motivated me to study science and to become a chemist and to learn about materials and toxicology. And now we can use these 40 years of claiming and shaming for innovation and quality. And that gives us the opportunity to make stuff in the United States even at a cheaper price, because we now can handle materials completely different. If you take a Mercedes-Benz, for example, in Germany, the costs for materials are about 1.5 times higher than for the labor costs. So if we learn to handle materials and energy properly, we can pay people much better to do the job. And it gives us the opportunity for quality jobs. If you look at the steel production, for example, we just finished a calculation here. 93% of the costs to make steel are energy and materials. Only 7% labor costs. So that gives us a completely new opportunity to handle stuff and rebuild industry in the United States. And that's what it's about, because it's no longer about sustainability. Sustainability is pretty boring.
What you just said, are the unions, pushing for this to happen? Let's redesign things so there's more money freed up for labor.
Yeah, the amazing thing is, in different countries, there are different organizations. There in the Netherlands, in Denmark, it's a big industries who lobby for that, because they see this as an innovation opportunity.
Uh-huh.
In Germany, for example, it's the world's largest trade union, the IG Metall. And they have 150,000 engineers, and they just don't want to be idiots. They want to be proud. They want to. It's no longer about sustainability, because, Charlene, if I would ask you, how is your relationship with your husband or your boyfriend, what would you say? Sustainable. I would be really sorry for you. It's just the minimum, like compostable. We can use this now for innovation, for quality, for beauty. A product which is connected to child labor has a quality problem. It's not beautiful.
Yeah.
And so it's about quality and innovation and beauty. And that's why we can look at these things as an innovation engine. And because of all these environmental debates, especially in California, but as well in New York and in the East and West Coast, but as well in the middle of the country, in Iowa, for example, very great people, or in Arkansas, even at Walmart, we now can use all these discussions for innovation and quality. And, for example, this week we put a collection of sports stuff on the market for Puma, one of these sport companies as well.
Uh-huh.
And all these things are designed. These are the first shoe soles which are designed for a cavalier start. Yeah? It's a traffic light, basically, because all the abrasion is designed for the biosphere. And on the other side, there is a complete take-back program by the company, which is done globally, as well in San Francisco in the store, like it's done in anywhere in Oklahoma, for example. It's the same way. Yeah. And that's nice now, because, and it's no longer about green. It's not about ethics anymore. It's about self-esteem. These young scientists just don't want to be idiots. These young designers just want to be proud of their work. And so somebody who is making a product which becomes waste is just an idiot. So it's enough, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in this country, though, all kinds of innovations have somehow plumped up the ownership class and not gone to the workers. So that's a political problem here, the fact that we're in the, you know, sort of death grip of corporate control over the government. But, as you say, when it seems so positive and the way forward, I'm wondering why, I don't know how many companies have availed themselves of your consulting service, but you have made the case that it saves companies money. And how many have, I mean, what are some stories in the United States? And also, why do you think others hold back?
Yeah, I think sometimes I'm not so much in the consulting business, because I'm more in the insulting business. Because when you take a company like Mattel, for example, we are analyzing the Mattel toys, which is the world's largest maker of toys. Yeah, but they make the stuff in China for $1. They put them in the market for $20. And we find in these Mattel toys about 500 to 600 really bad chemicals, which are dangerous for the environment, which are hazardous, etc. Yeah, and there, I'm really sometimes really sorry for them, because they really don't get it. Yeah? So these are chemical weapons against children. This is terrorism. This is homeland security as well. So this is really bad. But on the other side, there is such a great number of smart companies. Take, for example, Steelcase. Steelcase based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Steelcase, there's Jim Hackett, and he says, look, I want to be proud of what I'm doing. And he started with us in 94, 19 years ago, to work on changing all the Steelcase furniture into cradle to cradle. And last year, when the company had their 100th birthday, they could announce that nearly all their products are now cradle to cradle. The same with Herman Miller, with his beautiful office furniture as well.
Yeah.
The same, you mentioned already Shaw. Shaw is the world's largest maker of carpets. Yeah, and they definitely changed the things into cradle to cradle. Aveda, cosmetic companies, for example, textile companies, in all different places. Really, really smart, great people. So the country is about doing things. In Europe, sometimes people are talking too much. In the United States, people do things. At the university, I mostly get paid for keeping things unclear, because as long as things are unclear, there's funding. So I always need to put in more research than is necessary, otherwise I don't get funding for my PhD students anymore. Instead of saying, hey, wait a minute, why don't you really solve problems? We are talking in Europe about problems. Sometimes in the United States, people are a little too fast with finding answers, and this sometimes is a little shortcut which doesn't help. But we, Bill McDonough and I, are combining European complexity thinking with American ambition to get things done.
Uh-huh.
And that's why it's nice. We enjoy that, and we will see United States will change into cradle to cradle instead of cradle to crave, really to make products where there's no graveyard anymore on this planet. Everything will become nutrition for the biosphere and technosphere.
Uh-huh. So I remember in the story that I mentioned in the book, when you said some 60 firms declined to be in that project you did about, you know, making the inventory of what compounds shouldn't be used because they require more toxins, and arriving at the ones that could get the job done, making that fabric without being toxic. And you said the reason the 60 pulled out is they felt protective, secretive. They didn't want to reveal what chemicals they do use. Is that a main reason companies don't go for this, or why would they hold back, say, in the United States?
First of all, there's definitely a problem that people are afraid to deal with problems because they're afraid to generate a liability problem. Huh. So what we do is, from that perspective, we say, look, we want to make positive choices, not free of things. We define positively things to go into technical and biological systems. And sure, we take the European precautionary principle. So we don't wait till we have final evidence of a chemical being a carcinogen. If it's a perspective that it's suspected as a carcinogen, we take it out. Yeah? So, and sure, sometimes people deal with tradition. Take, for example, a PET bottle. Yeah? A PET bottle contains a catalyst, which is a strong carcinogen. And it's washed out by lemonade. It's washed out by orange juice. And then you find high concentrations of this heavy metal antimony in the drink. When you talk to a company which sells lemonade, yeah, they said, we are not selling drinking water, yeah, so we don't need to fulfill drinking water legislation, but it's a carcinogen anyway. But they were so afraid that they said, Michael, we didn't hear what you say, otherwise somebody might sue us for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's critical. The country has so many lawyers that they permanently try to make companies' lives, the country has so many lawyers that make companies' lives so much more difficult. And that's easier. So take a precautionary principle. Say, if there is a potential. So I'm, for example, with my colleagues, and we are analyzing breast milks, human milks, mussels milk, now for 26 years. And there's not one sample which you could sell as drinking milk.
I know.
Because the chemicals accumulate in there.
Yeah.
So why should I wait till they have final evidence that this makes cancer or this changes the hormone system? Yeah, should I do human testing with that? I say if it accumulates in breast milk, I want to take it out because the baby didn't ask for it. Yeah. We are against sexual harassment, but why aren't we against chemical harassment as well? Because the baby didn't ask for the stuff. And these are all synthetic chemicals. We find them as plasticizers in PVC. We find them in all different types of glues and additives and whatever. And it's completely unnecessary. The baby didn't ask for that. But still, breastfeeding is much better for the baby, but not longer than a maximum of 9 months. Because then the liver is functioning. But before that, the liver just doesn't function to metabolize these chemicals. So most of the stuff is just flushing through. And by the way, the mother can detoxify herself as well.
Right. Oh, yes, as much as possible. I have a section about that in the book, Relational Reality, and I have a big section about you and relational reality because you're such a big part of this relational shift in thinking. I go through all these different fields, and when it comes to this field of manufacturing, I just think you're really, you know, the pioneer here. What you said about the example in the lemonade, though, I mean, that's really chilling, you know, that the clean water standards, the neither FDA or the Ag Department, you know, imposes that on these bottled products. And we have just a couple minutes left, but by comparison, could you explain to people what the system is in the European Union for identifying and taking chemicals out of use, declaring that certain industrial chemicals cannot be used?
Yeah,
I mean, there's a whole index,
the system
isn't there?
It's called REACH. Yeah, it's Registration Evaluation of Chemicals. But it's still a negative system. We make positive choice. And let you know, I like to be a chemist, but I don't make chemicals, and my students don't do this, which accumulate in breast milk, because it's stupid. You're an idiot if you do so. So we take the precautionary principle where we say, if it accumulates, it cannot be used. Yeah? So we only make stuff which is designed for the biosphere or the technosphere, either because it comes from a natural substance or it's designed that it can go work like a natural substance, and we can handle this. And on the other side, you cannot make an energy-saving window without toxic stuff in it. Copper, for example, extremely toxic in biological systems. In technical systems, it can be used endlessly. So we have, for example, a new Philips TV, which is designed for indoor use. You know, normally, the indoor air quality in a building is 3 to 8 times worse than outside urban air in New York, because nothing is designed for indoor use. So we systematically make paint, which is cleaning air. We make carpets, which are cleaning air. So we make positive things, not less bad stuff. But the less bad regulation in Europe basically means that we take out the worst stuff, but that doesn't really help us, because we want to make healthy stuff. We want to celebrate a human footprint, not minimizing damage.
Yeah. Okay, down. We have really just about 1 minute left, but I'm so interested in that work you're doing in your new professorship.
I need to mention, Bill, my friend Bill is a little concerned, sometimes a little nervous. It's the 22nd of April. We will launch a new book called The Upcycle. It has a foreword by Bill Clinton as well. And I'm not sure whether we can reach the same quality of work, but it's not the intention, because when you have two children, you don't compare them to each other. This book collects the information which we learned over these years, and it gives you positive examples. It will be on the market in April, 22nd of April or 24th of April. And you can see what happened with that. And I'm very optimistic that people see the positive message. And we see Cradle is now supported as well by a lot of Hollywood celebrities, whether it's Susan Sarandon or Brad Pitt or Cameron Diaz. It's really amazing. People get a positive message. It's no longer about guilt. It's about celebrating a human footprint. It's about becoming native to the planet. We cannot delegate to be native to some aborigines. It's our planet.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, people can look on your website, brongart.com, to see information about this professorship, which I think is so interesting. And people, you said, in this tape, can come with small business problems, and they're used as case studies that the students solve for these young entrepreneurs. So I want to thank you so much. I really have to move on, but I really want to thank you, Michael Brongart. I'm so thrilled to sort of meet you, and thank you for coming on the program.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks for your kind questions and your really profound preparation. Thanks so much.
Okay. Well, let's amble over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there. Our poem this week is another one by the late Wisława Szymborska, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1996. And this one is from her collection entitled Monologue of a Dog. The poem is entitled Early Hour. I'm still asleep, but meanwhile, facts are taking place. The window grows white. Darknesses turn gray. The room works its way from hazy space. Pale, shaky stripes seek its support. By turns, unhurried, since this is a ceremony, the planes of walls and ceiling dawn. Shapes separate, one from the other, left to right. The distances between objects irradiate. The first glints twitter on the tumbler, the doorknob. Whatever had been displaced yesterday had fallen to the floor, been contained in picture frames, is no longer simply happening, but is. Only the details have not yet entered the field of vision. But look out, look out, look out. All indicators point to returning colors, and even the smallest thing regains its own hue along with a hint of shadow. This rarely astounds me, but it should. I usually wake up in the role of belated witness, with the miracle already achieved, the day defined, and dawning masterfully recast as morning. And for our song today, we'll hear another in our series of the Great Voices from Ohio. We've heard Tracy Chapman from Cleveland, Chrissy Hind from Akron, and the the great jazz singer Nancy Wilson from Columbus. Today, we're going to hear the opera star and concert performer Kathleen Battle, who is a lyric and coloratura soprano from Portsmouth, Ohio, which, as you all no doubt know, is located right where the Scioto River flows into the mighty Ohio. Kathleen Battle has won 3 Grammy Awards for Best Classical Vocal Soloist Performance of the Year, and 2 more Grammys for Best Opera Recording of the Year. Today we'll hear Kathleen Battle sing the Ave Maria from the one-act opera Cavalleria Rusticana by Mascagni. That was Kathleen Battle singing the Ave Maria by Mascagni. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you would like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab labeled Radio. Join me next week when my guest will be Nan Ellen, who will be talking about her new book, Good Urbanism. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.